You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome to the New Evangelicals Response. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Wednesday as we respond to commentary on the pressing issues of our day, offering a thoughtful response rooted in love, justice, inclusivity, and of course, non-dehumanization. Let's get into it. Hello, friends. All right, welcome in. It's been a few weeks since we did a YouTube Live, and this will, of course, eventually be on our podcast. It is good to have you. This is going to be, I don't know, maybe one of the most jaw-dropping videos that we're going to be responding to as of late. And there's a lot to get into, so I'm not going to waste too much time. If you're new to the channel, welcome. My name is Tim. I'm the creator of the New Evangelicals. We are a nonprofit organization holding space for people marginalized by the evangelical church, advocating for accountability inside of evangelical spaces, and helping people explore the Christian tradition beyond what I call is the basement of evangelical fundamentalism. And so this video, this response that we're doing is hopefully part of that, getting you out of the basement and thinking about things differently, but still being firmly seated somewhere in the Christian tradition. That's why we do these TNE response videos. Again, it's good to have all of you with us. Many of you are already watching live, and this is going to be a really interesting video. So my guest today is Dr. Randall Rouser. Hello, it's good to have you. Welcome, Randall, to the show. Thanks for making time.
Hey, glad to be with you, Tim.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then I'll go ahead and queue up the video that we're going to respond to today.
Sure. So let's see. I am a former professor of theology. I taught for 20 years at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, Canada. I have a PhD from King's College, University of London. I've written, I think, 16 books. Among them are Conversations with My Inner Atheist, The Doubter's Creed, Progressive Christians Love Jesus Too, and my most recent, not my most recent one 2 years ago, but the one that's relevant for what we're talking about, which is Jesus Loves Canaanites, Biblical Genocide in the Light of Moral Intuition. Right now, these days, for the last year, I've been full-time working as an investigator with a company called Veritas Solutions, where we investigate issues of abuse within workplace settings, including churches. And indeed, my specialty is to work with churches and faith-based organizations to address issues of abuse, such as harassment and bullying and sexual harassment. And wow. I'm glad to be with you today.
Awesome. Love that. Well, I'm not going to waste too much of our time because we have a lot to get into with this video. So I'm going to tee it up for the audience. So audience, here's what's going on. Okay. There's a video that just came out by Alex O'Connor. He is an atheist, but honestly, I really like his content a lot. He has some very engaging guests on, people that I disagree with strongly, like folks like Michael Knowles. He debated Ben Shapiro, and I really appreciate his approach. He's very intelligent and also, I think, very fair. He most recently had on William Lane Craig. Now, William Lane Craig, I would say, and Randall, tell me if I'm wrong, he's one of the leading evangelical apologist philosophers out there, I think, as far as how well read he is, meaning how many books he sells and just how he gets around. And he had William Lane Craig on to talk about two things. Number one, why Richard Dawkins won't debate him. And that reason being because of William Lane Craig's view on the Canaanite slaughter that God orders the Israelites to commit in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. And so I watched this whole interview with between Alex and William Lane Craig. And I got to say, I knew that William Lane Craig held these positions, but hearing him reiterate them in 2024 and the way that he does made me, my jaw really drop. Like I truly was like, wow, this is to hear an apologist argue for this position as a just position. So I figured that I would get someone who I respected on. So Randall, I reached out to you, said, hey, you've been around this circle, you know, a time or two. Why don't you join me and we'll go live and we'll kind of watch this interview between Alex and William Lane Craig and respond as needed. Any other details I'm missing on this video that you want to add?
I would just say in terms of some quick background on Craig, just to emphasize how important he is as a figure. So he came out with his first PhD in, I believe, 1979 or 77, in the late 70s, on the Kalam cosmological argument and philosophy. Then in 1984, he did a second PhD in New Testament on the historical resurrection of Jesus. And that's really provided the foundation for his apologetic method to focus on issues like the creation of the universe and historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And in the last 40 years, he has really been the leading Christian debater in the world in terms of apologetics. He runs a ministry called Reasonable Faith, has a spate of probably a few dozen books, some popular and some written at a high academic level in areas like the philosophy of time. And he's also, I wouldn't say a dabbler, but he's like focuses or he explores other areas. And this is one of those areas that is not central to his work, but which he has commented on a few occasions, this interview being one of them. So he's not a fringe figure. He's a mainstream figure, probably the most important figure in contemporary Christian apologetics. That's what makes it especially relevant.
I think that's well said. And also, I want to say he's quite brilliant. I mean, he writes prolifically. I'm not saying that he's not intelligent or anything like that. You know, this is not about that at all. I think he's quite intelligent, way more than I am. And so that's what made, I think, all of these statements that much more shocking. So, all right, well, let's just go ahead and hop into it. And Randall, I gave you the rules ahead of time. Whenever you want to pause, just let me know. We can pause and we can comment and we'll get through it. Friends, thanks for being here. Buckle up. This one is a doozy. Here we go.
Whether this be the real reason or not, the reason he gives is that William Lane Craig is an immoral person because he is an apologist for genocide, pointing specifically in his original article and original objection to the issue of the slaughter of the Canaanites in the Hebrew Bible, which you've defended as a morally defensible thing for God to have commanded and for the Israelites to have enacted. So what I really want to do now is jump into this story. I want to talk about the slaughter of the Canaanites in the Hebrew Bible, what happened, why it's problematic, and what your moral defense is of that story. So perhaps we can begin by talking about who were the Canaanites?
All right. Prior to Israel's liberation from bondage in Egypt, the land of Canaan, or modern-day Israel, was populated by small clans of Canaanite inhabitants. And according to the biblical narrative, these clans of Canaanites were extremely evil. They were debauched morally and opposed God, and God let this go on for 400 years while Israel was in Egypt. But then he called Israel out of Egypt and led them to the land of Canaan and delivered the land over to Israel and said, drive out the Canaanites from the land on pain of death. And I am giving this land to you, to Israel. So they were the pre-Israeli inhabitants of this region of the world on the eastern coast of the Mediterranean Sea.
And as you say, the Old Testament makes it clear that God considered these people to be an immoral people, much in the same way that before the flood of Noah, we sort of have this pleading with God of saying, look, are there not any good people amongst this community? Are you really going to flood the entire world? Is there not one person worth saving? And as far as I know, most people defend God's action here by saying that the answer is no, that the society had become so corrupt that there wasn't any sort of salvageable morality. And I suppose something like that is going on with the Canaanites here. I suppose... Yes.
If I might comment, this is not simply biblically attested. I have a colleague, Professor Clay Jones, who has done a study of ancient literature coming out of pre-Israelite Canaan. And it is horrific, the culture that is described there. This was one that practiced not only all sorts of human sexual aberrations, but also temple prostitution in the worship of God. They practiced bestiality. There are texts describing how a buck would be strapped down to a wooden frame, and then women would mount the buck and copulate with it. They were engaged in offering child sacrifice to their gods. And so reading these ancient documents that are from pre-Israelite Canaan really bear out the truth of the biblical description of them, though the biblical description doesn't go into that kind of morbid detail that these documents do.
Perfect. I was going to pause here anyway. Go ahead.
Perfect. So, okay, so several things here. First of all, Bill Craig gives his background. So it was a 400 years that of prior sinning before that he finally lowered the boom and justly sort of evacuated the Canaanites. And what one thing we always want to do is we want to try to, when particular rationales are being invoked to justify behaviors, consider whether you can generalize that rationale. And if you can't, then that becomes an instance of special pleading that you're trying, and that's a logical fallacy. You're trying to apply something in one case that you wouldn't apply in another case. For example, so let's say that you have today a country where for 400 years, people in the one country have been acting unjustly toward another people or something. Does that warrant you now eradicating the current population based upon the 400 years of behavior prior to their existence?
Right.
Now, interestingly, in the Bible itself, you have people like Ezekiel saying, no, each person is responsible for their own sins. You can't punish one person for the sins of their ancestors. And yet there is an implicit appeal here to this idea of imputing the guilt of 400 years of history onto the current population. A couple other things. One is that, Craig talks about this scholar, Clay Jones, who says, well, here's evidence from scholars or from the literature of the Canaanites that they were really wicked people and they had to be eradicated. And then he gives relatively graphic example of a description of a woman having intercourse with an animal. Okay. Now, the interesting thing, now, Craig is appealing there to a journal article that Clay Jones, who's a philosopher, an apologist, he's not an ancient historian, he's not an archaeologist, he doesn't specialize in the ancient Near East, he's an evangelical apologist, and he wrote an article 15 years ago in Philosophia Christi magazine where he made this argument. And what he's doing is he's cherry-picking Canaanite sources. And if he finds some shocking statement in it, then he uses that as a rationale or justification for eradicating the entire population. Now, where he really shows how shocking that logic is that he then applies that to contemporary American society in that journal article. He gives a couple examples. He says, for example, he quotes lyrics from a Metallica song, which is actually a cover of a Motorhead song from 1998. Which appears to make reference to graphic, violent, sexual content. And he also refers to a film that came out in about 2007 and played the festival circuit, in which there's a theme of a woman doing a sexual act with a dog. And he generalizes from those examples to justify that America today is morally equivalent to ancient Canaan. Now, imagine if we followed that logic through and thought that based upon this cherry picking of relatively obscure contemporary cultural snippets, you could justify the mass eradication of the American population. It would be moral insanity, yet that is equivalent to what he is arguing with ancient Canaan.
That is helpful. That's what I was hoping you were going to say, because I'm like, this Clay Jones person, I don't know who he is. I hope that you do. And, you know, Jonathan in our comments said kind of the same thing. He said this as well. It should be noted that archaeology reveals a different history for the history of Canaan. I believe that my understanding from people that I talk to who are in the academic world who, you know, study this stuff, they say the general consensus is that the biblical account versus the archaeological evidence are two different things. Is that your understanding as well?
Okay, yeah, there's a few things here. So first of all, and I'm not an ancient Near Eastern scholar, but I have read them, you know, in virtue of the book I wrote on the topic and that. And the standard view is that the Canaanites, what we can know through archaeology, they're not demonstrably worse than any other ancient Near Eastern peoples. So that's the first thing. They're not egregiously evil in the way that Craig describes them here. The second thing is there's also wide open debate about how Canaanites relate to Israelites. And one of the mainstream views in the ancient Near Eastern studies is that the Israelites actually emerged from the Canaanite tribes themselves.
Right.
Now, the one thing we want to keep in mind is that the most common dating for these narratives of what we call the Deuteronomic history, which includes Deuteronomy and Joshua, is that these really emerged out of some pre-existing forms, but they really emerged in the 600s BC, which would be about 700-800 years after the events that they allegedly describe. So my question is, how convinced should we be in the historicity of something that only reaches final written form 800 years after the events it allegedly narrates?
Yeah.
I think we'd be pretty circumspect about that. So I think we really have to be careful about reading these texts as sober history. There's also a whole conversation about the problems that the archaeological digs have shown. For example, I believe it was Kathleen Kenyon in the 1950s showing that at the time that Joshua allegedly destroyed Jericho, it was uninhabited. So these are ongoing conversations, but there's certainly a lot of historical questions here.
Yeah.
One more quick thing, if I may.
Well, please.
One of the things Craig referenced as justifying the eradication of Canaanites was the sacrifice of children. Now, a couple things here. First of all, think about the logic of this, because one of the things Craig is defending in this video is killing children.
Right.
He's defending Israelites under divine command, killing Canaanite children and infants. And of course, I'm sure we're going to come to that later on.
Oh,
but
we
the
are.
Logic then, the logic is that he punishes the Canaanites, God punishes the Canaanites on this narrative for killing their children by killing their children, which there's not a lot of logic there. Now, one more thing, he also says the Canaanites are sacrificing their children. Well, Susan Nitich wrote a book. She's a scholar. I believe it's War in the Hebrew Bible, came out in 1993. And she argues, and I think she's right about this, that there are themes of sacrifice throughout Joshua itself, that this Yahweh war of the Canaan, of the Israelites coming into the land of Canaan, is itself a holy ritual war. That's why the priests lead the armies to the cities. And then they're offering up, as per the directions of Deuteronomy 20, they're offering up the Canaanites and all of their animals and their material possessions to Yahweh as harem, which is they're giving him over to God as like a sacrifice. And then we have the description of the smoke rising from Jericho, which really calls to mind the image of the burnt sacrifice and the smoke rising of the burnt sacrifice to the deity. So actually, there's a good argument to be made that what the Israelites are doing to the Canaanites is itself a form of human sacrifice to Yahweh. And so it just doubles down the irony that not only are you killing children in retaliation for the killing of children, you're sacrificing children in retaliation for the sacrifice of children.
Great words. I have no notes. We'll continue on.
I suppose I intuitively find it difficult to believe that there's not a single person in this community who is not so like unsalvageably touched or consumed by sin in this way, that the actions we see the Israelites committing on the command of God can be justified. So to give people an idea, to give them the full picture, we've described who the Canaanites are, and I'm sure you'll have something to say about that. But the reason that this is a problem, the reason why Richard Dawkins is talking about these people, is because, as you say, God promises this land to the Israelites, and he waits 400 years and says this is because the sin sort of hasn't got bad enough yet, essentially. He says it will happen in 400 years because by that point things will be so bad that this will be worth, this will be sort of justifiably inflicted. But he commands the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites. And the language used in the Bible is quite extreme in a few different areas, talking about completely destroying a city, leaving nothing alive that breathes. And on the point about innocent people, because I know you'll have something to say about that, but we know that there are at least some innocent people among the Canaanites, because in the sixth chapter of Joshua, in the destruction of Jericho, it said that they devoted the city to the Lord and destroyed with the sword every living thing in it, men and women, young and old, cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Now, maybe the men and women were immoral. I certainly don't think that children living among the Canaanites were immoral enough to justify their being killed, and certainly not the cattle, the sheep, and the donkeys.
I just want to say, what's so interesting about this video is that I find myself with Alex the entire time. Like the guy who's an atheist, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a follower of Jesus, and I'm watching a Christian talk to an atheist. And my position is so far the one of like Alex's objections are also my objections, you know? So just an interesting like note to point out for the audience.
Evangelical apologists, they'll kind of say, well, if you don't believe in God or even the Christian God, you don't have any basis to make moral judgments. I mean, I think that's just manifestly false. Mm. You know, in the same way that you don't need to know how your sense perception works in order to know that you are sense perceiving the world around you. So you don't necessarily need to have some meta-ethical account of the nature of moral good and obligation to know that there's such a thing as good and evil, right and wrong. And so whether or not you think Alex's philosophical account of the nature and origin of morality is satisfactory or not, there's no doubt that he has justified moral grounds to raise the kind of critical objections to Craig that he's raising.
Yeah, good point.
The difficult, I think, aspect of this is the children. The adults were corrupt. If there was an innocent person among the adults, that person didn't have to be killed. It's important to understand that God's command to Israel was not genocide, despite a superficial first reading of these narratives. More fundamentally, it was a command to drive the Canaanites out of the land on pain of death. No one had to be killed if these tribes would simply retreat and flee in the face of the advancing Israeli army. It was only those who tried to stay behind and resist who were to be completely exterminated. So,
okay,
people.
Yeah, can we just? I go ahead. Yeah, you're the guest here, Randall. You go first. I insist.
I appreciate that. Okay, first of all, I want to kind of work backwards. So, Craig, he's doing his best here, but he's trying to say, look, if only you had fled for your life, you wouldn't have died. It's like imagine if somebody said to you, give up your home, your land, your city, everything you've ever known, and flee off into the woods or we'll kill you. And then if you resist that, it's your fault. I mean, that's what I call gaslighting of the first order. That's first thing.
Holy moly.
Second thing is, even if you can see what Craig is describing here, this is what we call ethnic cleansing, which has been a category in international law since Bosnia-Herzegovina in the early 1990s. And that's bad. Ethnic cleansing is bad. It's a war crime. It's a crime against humanity. But the third thing, to go back to the beginning, he says it's not genocide. It is genocide. Okay, we have to consider what is genocide. Genocide, by definition, international law, 1948, the Convention on the Prevention of the Punishment and Crime of Genocide is the following: killing members of the group, causing seriously bodily or mental harm to the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its destruction in whole or part, imposing measures intended to prevent births in the group, and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Now, if you read passages like Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 20, God is saying, destroy all of their culture, kill them, and anybody who remains in the land, or forcibly drive them out or kill them. That would meet the legal definition of genocide any day. That is genocide. They're trying to destroy Canaanite identity as such. So it is genocide. I think why apologists like Craig are so keen to say it's not genocide is because they recognize the moral weight that comes with that legal judgment, but they should experience that moral weight because it is a crime against humanity, what he's proposing here.
Yeah, no, you took the words right out of my mouth. I completely agree. And to hear him say that, well, they didn't have to be killed if they just ran. It's if you bring it to your own local context, if it's your property, if it's your land, if it's America, there are people who would rather easily die than flee into the woods somewhere because this is, you know, their land, not the foreign invaders. So that's a really good point. All right, well, keep it going.
Didn't have to die. They weren't pursued and chased down until everyone was exterminated. These clans were driven out of the land. They were be destroyed as nation states, but not as individual people. And it's important to understand that for these ancient Near Eastern people, as for modern Near Eastern people, it is the land that is so important. It is all about the land. Even today, when you go to Israel, people will talk about coming to the land. That's how they refer to it. So what God was doing was giving the land of Canaan from to Israel and divesting these Canaanite clans of the possession of the land of Canaan. And so they were driven out, and not all of them were killed. Later in the narratives in the Pentateuch, you find Canaanites still about.
Yeah.
So they weren't all killed.
If I may, on this point that we've got to so far.
Yeah, go ahead.
Firstly, this
again,
idea.
I just want to come back to, he says, well, not all of them were killed. I mean, you know, if you go to Rwanda, not all of the Tutsis were killed. Some of them survived.
Yeah.
Does that mean that the Rwandan genocide that unfolded between April and June of 1994 was not a genocide? I mean, the implication here that you have to have successfully eradicated every person in the group for the event to qualify as somehow a heinous war crime is just boggles the imagination.
Why do you think it's easy for people like William Lane Craig, and really even myself growing up as an evangelical, to kind of have like a different standard for, oh, this happened in the Bible, so it's not as bad as we think. But then when we think about genocide today, we think about, whoa, you know, like, for example, I mean, the Holocaust, right? We think about the weightiness of something like that, and we go, how could that ever happen? But when we read about the systemic killing of a people group in the Bible, our brain goes, well, God ordained it, so it's not a big deal. Like, what do you think is happening there to make those things so different, even though they're really the same thing?
There's a lot going on there. I think one
okay,
thing
fair.
One thing is that people are taught to read the Bible as a straightforward historical narrative from Adam through Jesus through to the end of Revelation, so that if you divert from the historicity of any of that, there's a slippery slope thinking that, well, then why believe anything? Like, if you don't believe that this literally happened, why believe Jesus rose from the dead?
Right.
And I mean, my basic point in response to that is, look, Christianity is summarized in the Apostles' Creed quite well. And yeah, central to that is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Not central to that are particular ways to interpret the Deuteronomic narrative. Mm. So Christians should recognize that there are and have always been different voices on how to interpret these. In the fourth century, Gregory of Nyssa, who was one of the founders of Cappadocian Orthodoxy, so in other words, one of the most important theologians and Orthodox theologians of the fourth century, he denied that God literally killed the firstborn in Egypt because he said that would be an evil crime to just indiscriminately kill every child, no matter their age, from all of the families of Egypt. That would be an example of somebody recognizing there's a fundamental contradiction between your historical narrative reading of the text and your fundamental convictions as a Christian. Origen wrestled with the same thing in the third century, but we're not given those tools today, sadly, in many evangelical context to recognize that you don't have to interpret everything in a historical wooden sense in order to be a Christian or to accept the authority and value of Scripture.
Yeah, that's good. Friends, I am so excited to be partnering with Middle Church to promote their event, Freedom Rising, happening April 26th to the 28th, sponsored by the Candler Foundry and happening at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. This is a three-day conference that you do not want to miss. Find rest, learn how to organize political power, and dream expansively about the world we deserve. And let me tell you, this is a monster speaker lineup with absolute legends, including Dr. Jackie Lewis, Reverend Dr. William Barbara, Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas, and Robert P. Jones, the founder of the PRRI Institute, which is the place I get all of my Christian nationalism data. This is going to be a three-day event full of learning about how to take care of you and your body, how to take action on crucial issues, and how to live into different ways of being in the world. I plan on being there, and I cannot wait to see you there as well. Get your tickets now at freedomrising.org and be part of this transformative experience. That's freedomrising.org, April 26th to the 28th in New York City. I'll see you there. You move the world.
Hello, my name is Sharon Roggio. I am the director of 1946, the movie. We know that there is harmful rhetoric that seeps into our culture that sometimes comes from our church buildings. We know the impact of fundamentalist theology that is designed to uplift certain groups and marginalize others. We also recognize that this is an issue that needs to be dealt with care and empathy, as oftentimes it is our loved ones who uphold these beliefs. And that is why I support Project Amplify. Never in our lives have we been more inundated with misinformation and disinformation, but Project Amplify provides good information and a middle ground to give us some hope around a lot of this misguided information and beliefs. If you'd like to help Project Amplify, please consider a donation today, and you can find out more with the click in the link below. Thank you.
Not everybody's killed because they're given the opportunity to leave their land. They're given the opportunity to be driven out. It's only if they stay and resist that they get killed. And the way you just cash that out is by saying, so they had a decision and didn't have to die. It seems to me that, of course, you're going to understand this as something that God has commanded. So whatever the reason may be, it must be the morally right thing to do. However, from my perspective, what I'm seeing here is a foreign nation approaching the native inhabitants of land which they believe is their own, saying, you need to leave. And when they refuse, killing them and then saying, well, look, I gave you a choice, didn't I? Because you could have just left. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, in other words, doesn't seem like much of a defense to me.
Right. We were talking about whether or not the Canaanites were corrupt and whether or not this was an act of divine judgment upon them. But I've not explicated here the moral theory that undergirds my defense of this action. It is very possible that had this been undertaken by human initiative alone, that it would have been immoral, as the way you described. But the ethical theory that I defend is called divine command morality. And this has two components to it. First is that the good is based in God himself. God is the paradigm of moral goodness. He is by nature loving, fair, just, and so forth. Second element is that God's nature then expresses itself toward us in the form of divine commands that constitute our moral duties. According to this theory, moral obligations arise as a result of imperatives issued by a qualified authority. So, for example, if I were driving and some random person told me to pull over, I wouldn't have any obligation to obey that person at all. But if a policeman commanded me to pull over, then in virtue of his authority, I would have a legal obligation to pull over and obey what he's done. And so the theory is that moral obligations arise as a result of imperatives issued by the paradigm of goodness himself, who is God. Now,
all right. We'll pause there. Go ahead.
Okay, so Craig is introducing here a meta-ethic, in other words, an account of the origin of the nature of, in this case, moral obligation. He says, so there are these two, well, there's at least these two big areas in morality. So there's moral value, which is good and evil. And he says on his view, moral goodness is like identified in some respect with God's nature. It just is who God is. God is the perfect exemplar of moral perfection.
Right.
And then he goes on, and fair enough, a Christian can take that view, and probably more do than don't.
Sure.
Now, the other option is what is the nature of obligation? In other words, right and wrong. What makes it such that I have to do something rather than another thing? Because it seems that obligations are some new thing above and beyond simply the existence of values. And what Craig says is, on his account, obligations come from the fact that God tells us to do things in virtue of his moral nature. God commands us to do one thing and not another.
Right.
And then he says, well, that's just my account for what's happening here. God commanded this to happen, and so they are morally obliged to undertake these actions. They're morally obligatory and good actions. Now, technically, we can say, yeah, that's possible. Anything is possible, right? I mean, it's a logically coherent view. The question is, should we think it's true? The one thing I would want to point out here is that, see, on my view, I am sympathetic with a divine command approach to obligation. In other words, to thinking obligations do come from divine commands. But there's no reason to think that divine commands just come in the way he seems to suppose of God discreetly telling a person, hey, go do this. It could be that divine commands come through our moral intuitions. In other words, as I reflect on the idea of killing and stabbing and bludgeoning an infant, I experience an overwhelming sense of the moral wrongness of that action. And that is my moral perceptual faculty grasping with the divine command never to kill an infant. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, you could have a divine command theory. It doesn't mean anything goes in the way that Craig seems to surmise here. And one thing I'd like to ask Craig, if you believe God can command the butchering and slaughtering of infants, could God command rape? Could God command torture? Could God command cannibalism? Do you know that he could never have a morally sufficient reason within his providential governance of the universe to command those things? I don't think he could give you a clear answer on that. I think that a sort of moral skepticism flows from his position because we don't know the range of what God could possibly command if our moral intuitions are as fundamentally as unreliable as Craig seems to think.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, also, the other thing I think about a lot, too, is, you know, Craig is reading the story in the Bible, and then God said, does Craig think that, like, out of a booming voice, you know, out of the air, that was the voice of God to these people saying, you there, you know, go ahead and slaughter? Like, how do they actually hear the voice of God, right? I think we kind of take it for granted because we're reading it as a narrative, and it's kind of, what's the term? Anthropomorphized? What's the word I'm looking for here?
Anthropomorphizing?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of levels taken for granted to get to, look, God commanded this, and here's how we know how, because they wrote it down. Therefore, it's a morally just decree. So it's just very interesting to witness Craig kind of like build this case out that just to me, to your point, seems so counterintuitive to anything I know to be moral or just or good or et cetera, you know?
Yeah. Presumably, God doesn't issue commands to himself as to what he should do. And therefore, on this theory, God has no moral obligations to fulfill. And therefore, as you rightly said, it's impossible that God could do something wrong because right and wrong are defined by divine commands, and God doesn't issue commands to himself to obey. So what constraint is there then on the moral commands of God? Well, it will be his own perfectly good nature, his own just and loving nature that will determine whether or not a command is available to him. Now, what this means is that there are lots of actions then that God can perform that would be prohibited morally to us. For example, you wouldn't have the moral right to kill me, but if God wants to strike me dead right now, that's his prerogative. God takes and gives life as he will. So if God wills to end the life of the Canaanite children prematurely, that's his prerogative. So God doesn't have the same sort of moral constraints.
Go ahead.
Just quickly, so notice the language he uses there. If God wants to end the lives of the Canaanite children prematurely, now that is a way of describing what is actually being commanded in a dispassionate way that seeks to keep us at length from the moral horror of it. Mm. We're not just talking about ending the Canaanite lives, the children's lives prematurely, as bad as that may seem. We're talking about Israelite soldiers taking the two main weapons they would have had, swords and spears, and stabbing and impaling and hacking infants and small children. Cutting off their limbs, chopping off their heads, disemboweling them, maybe taking a rock in a case when they're trying to escape and bludgeoning them and crushing their skull. That's the kind of thing that Craig is talking about God having commanded. And it's not like they just cease to exist in a moment, like, voop, they're gone. No, in many cases, they would slowly die an agonizing death. Genocide and mass killing of this kind is always messy. When I wrote my book, I did an extensive comparison between the ancient Canaanite genocide and contemporary Rwandan genocide, which is why I mentioned it earlier. And you could have people dying slowly, horrific deaths over hours or even days. That's what we're talking about. Not just God withdrawing the life of a child and they suddenly are vaporized in a moment.
I think that I honestly appreciate, even though I know it was graphic, I appreciate that you actually spelled it out, because I think sometimes we kind of gloss over exactly what we're talking about and like the implications of what things like what William Lane Craig is saying, because you're right. It's not like God said, okay, I'm just going to, you know, zap you guys up to heaven now, you know, and you'll be all happy. I mean, it was a very painful, excruciatingly gruesome scene that God commanded, it's not that God's own hand did this. God commanded other people to commit this act to other people, right? So it's human on human violence in William Lane Craig's perspective from the command of God. But no matter how you slice it, other humans did this to other humans. And that's an important factor.
That we do, because he doesn't have moral obligations to fulfill. He has to act only in consistency with his own nature.
Actually, can I pause here? I want to ask, Evan brought up a good question that I kind of had too. I'm going to bring him into the chat. Evan says, wait, God doesn't have the same moral devices as us, but doesn't he think we got morals from God? And I guess what I think, Evan, what I hear him asking is, I was always taught that like we know about morals because God in the Bible, and that's how we get our moral foundation. But William Lane Craig seems to be saying that God can operate in ways that are still moral for God to operate in, but are not moral for humans to operate in. So it seems to kind of build a separation between how we as humans can know objective moral truth. Because if God could do whatever he wants, presumably, and issue, you know, slaughter of the, or, you know, issue genocidal commands, but we can't do that, it seems like there's a discrepancy there. Does that make sense?
I would say that there's two to just kind of characterize what I think Craig is talking about here in a couple different ways.
Okay.
So first of all, Craig is distinguishing between God and all non-divine beings by saying, so God issues commands. And again, I think we can say he does, but if he does, I would say we primarily know about them through our most basic moral intuitions and we reason from those intuitions. We don't simply know about them from discrete religious experiences where we think God told me to do this. Anything that where we think that happens has to be dependent upon its consistency with those basic moral intuitions, I would say, for the most part. But I understand Craig's view is, well, God's going to issue commands to all creatures, but God's not going to issue commands to himself. And I think one reason to say God wouldn't issue commands to himself and thus technically wouldn't have moral obligations is because God is by definition morally perfect. So you'd only need moral obligations for creatures that are not perfect and thus would not always act consistently with the perfect good. So it's unnecessary for God to issue obligations to God's self. The other thing that I think is going on here is that Craig is making, I think, a legitimate distinction between God having certain powers and rights that creatures don't have in virtue of us not being God. And I think he gave the example of like a police officer. It's like a police officer can exceed the speed limit in accord with their status as a police officer, but we can't. And so similarly, there are things God could be justified in doing, you could say, such as withdrawing life, right? That God is not morally obliged to maintain every creature in existence in perpetuity. But you could say, well, maybe we don't have the right to bring about the death of a creature in the same way that God does. And I mean, I think I can recognize that as a distinction. But what we're talking about here is a whole different level of something. We're talking about God commanding people to do certain actions to other people, which we recognize to be moral atrocities.
Got it. That's a helpful distinction. I appreciate you clarifying, because I was also wrestling with trying to understand, you know, those two things. So thank you. All right, well, keep it going. This is, Randall, very, very helpful. Thank you for clarifying so much. I think your points have been spot on so far. So, and friends, thanks for watching. I'm glad that you're all here watching this live. If you're listening to this on the podcast, thanks for listening.
And so when you think of it in those terms, Alex, the problem posed by the conquest narrative is as follows. It's very similar to the problem of evil, that there is a sort of internal inconsistency between two propositions affirmed by the Judeo-Christian faith. The first would be that God is all just and all loving. And the second, in this case, would be that God has issued a command to Israel to drive out the Canaanites on pain of death from the land. And so my argument is that those two propositions are completely consistent with each other, because God wrongs no one in issuing such a command. And if he wrongs no one, then there is no moral constraint on his issuing such a command.
Now, I see a few problems with this, and I think my listeners will too intuitively. There's nothing I can say to prove that that's wrong, that maybe God can just permit things like the killing of innocent children by an Israelite clan. Maybe that is just okay. But the problems this raises include things like this is raised by Randall Rouser. He points out that this seems to undermine...
Is this the same Randall Rouser? Here we go.
Our ability to trust moral intuition. In other contexts, such as in the moral argument for the existence of God, you might appeal to the fact that we all know that certain things are morally right and morally wrong, and we sort of use that feeling to say that there must be some objective element of morality in the universe, and we use that to construct an argument for the existence of God. It seems, as Rouser points out, that nothing could be more intuitively wrong to me in this regard than the killing of an innocent child. And what we're told to believe is that, okay, maybe most of the time that's wrong. Maybe that's always wrong unless it's specifically commanded by God. But sometimes it is actually just okay as long as God commands it, meaning that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with killing innocent children. Can't be intrinsically wrong if there are circumstances in which it's actually not just permitted, but in fact, the thing that you're ordered to do.
Yeah, I actually really, when Alex said that, I said exactly. When I watched this for the first time, I'm thinking, if God can command people to kill children and wipe them out, and to your point, bludgeon them to death, then there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's only wrong because God says that it's wrong unless God changes their mind on it for some reason. So I thought that was a very compelling point that I thought also, I don't know, to me, it kind of undermined the notion that I grew up hearing a lot about of, hey, we can know objective moral truth just because of, you know, how we find it either in the Bible or how we understand God, because it's inherently good because of who God is. But all of a sudden, this seems to kind of flip that on its head where it's, well, it is inherently good as long as God says it is. And once God says it's not, then it's automatically okay, no matter how ugly that thing, in this case, genocide, actually is. Go ahead, Randall.
Yeah. I mean, just two things I want to add there. So first of all, in terms of buttressing the points in my book, and often when I talk about this, I quote from Eleanor Stump. She's a very well-known and brilliant Christian philosopher. And I'll just summarize. I'll get the last bit of her quote that I usually cite. She says, if we found that our ethical theory countenanced Nazi experiments on children, we'd throw away the theory as something evil itself. Mm. And I would just say, in the same way that you would measure any ethical theory you're going to propose by its implications for something like Nazi experiments on children, so you're going to measure it by its implications for how you treat civilians, specifically infants, small children, in the manner that Craig does here. And I think based upon that kind of cedence to moral intuition or deference to moral intuition, we ought to say that our moral intuitions are going to trump anything Craig is going to say in this regard. Now, the one other thing I just want to say is Craig said, well, I'm making these things consistent. So he's holding up the bar of logical consistency as the measure that he wants to defend. He says, well, it's consistent, so it's okay. And yeah. I want to say consistency is a low bar. So here's an analogy. One of the main objections in the problem of evil that any apologist today is going to have to wrestle with is the problem of natural evil or the suffering of animals. How do you explain the suffering of animals with respect to God being a loving creator? Well, one view was the view that was defended by René Descartes. And Descartes said that animals are not conscious. Only human beings are conscious, and thus animals do not suffer. So if you go into a slaughterhouse and you hear the screaming of cows as they're being slaughtered, he said that's just like the machine, the gears of a machine grinding together. It's not actual suffering. And that's logically consistent, and that addresses the problem of evil, much like Craig's statement that, oh, well, these were just commanded. These children were commanded to be killed. But who would be satisfied with explaining the problem of natural evil and animal suffering by simply saying, well, animals aren't conscious? Yeah, it's consistent, but I think it's also false and completely implausible. And I would simply say the same thing to Craig's apologetic.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, hey, friends, we're chugging along here. Let's keep going.
I would say that it is wrong in the absence of a divine command, but that God has the ability to override that by issuing a divine command, which then becomes our moral duty. And as long as this ethical theory is possible and coherent, then there just is no inconsistency between his being all good and all loving and his issuing a command of this sort. In the absence of a divine command, as I say, it could well have been immoral. But given the presence of divine command, it becomes the moral obligation of those persons to whom it was issued.
I think the only thing about this that really gets me is that if someone today did something, if someone today committed a mass shooting and said, listen, God gave me a moral command to do it, no one would be like, oh, well, hey, you're right. You know, God gave you a moral command, so it must have been just. Like, we would never think about anything like what William Lane Craig is talking about now in any capacity as being justified because you thought God told you to do it, right? And so I really like what you said, Randall, with like that intuitive moral sensibility that we have kind of being in sync with how we understand, you know, God's divine, moral decrees, so to speak, because that seems to me to actually solve the issue of, well, how do we know what's moral or not? You know, and the idea of, well, God gave me a command to do this. How do you, it would never hold weight today ever in any circumstance. So I don't know why we think it holds weight because it's in the Bible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. I think a lot of people, the way they address what is a deep cognitive dissonance is by saying, well, that was for an exceptional period of history, that the Canaanites were uniquely evil, that God needed to protect the Israelites as his chosen people in order to bless the nations. And so these extreme circumstances of mass genocidal slaughter were required. But one thing I would want to point out is, nowhere in the Bible is there a verse that says, heretofore, everyone here, the God no longer will ever issue a command to engage in the mass killing of civilians. There's nothing like that. Mm. So if, in fact, you do believe this, the great danger to bring it into the present is that you could believe conditions arise in the present that warrant that kind of killing again. And as someone who taught church history for 20 years in a seminary, I can tell you there's no shortage of examples like the Crusades of Christians who appealed yes. to patterns of texts like mass holy war killing, like Joshua, in order to justify the eradication of enemy populations such as they had conceived them. Oliver Cromwell engaging in genocide of the Irish, or Puritans justifying, like Cotton Mather justifying slaughter of indigenous peoples in North America. Time and again, you see this happening. And I've met people and know people who will talk about the book of Revelation and the mass killing of Revelation, and as they interpret it, these apocalyptic passages, and saying, you know, Christians could be called into this in the future. And when you have Christian nationalists today increasingly talking about building a Christian state and killing their enemies, yes. And they've yes. got a rationalizing framework for that from these passages, it really brings home how important this issue is.
Thank you. That is exactly right. I mean, the other day at John MacArthur Shepherd's Conference, I think his name was Will Lawson, said something to the effect of, you know, Christ is coming back to slaughter his enemies. That's what he said. And it's like this stuff can easily get recycled again. And woe to us who do not learn from history, especially Christian history, because you're right. This is how these things, you know, start happening. So I think what you said is really good and really important for us to recognize.
Now, so it doesn't undermine our moral intuitions about what's right and wrong. It just introduces the qualification of a divine command.
But it would mean that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with taking the life of an innocent child. Nothing intrinsically wrong with
it. Well, again, this is going to depend on your moral theory, Alex. I think that right and wrong, moral obligations, are determined by imperatives issued by a qualified authority. And so in the absence of such imperatives, there literally is no right and wrong. It's a subjective illusion of human consciousness. And I think this is one of the real problems of atheism, is that lacking a moral lawgiver and moral authority, it has no basis for affirming objective right and wrong. These are just either patterns of behavior that have emerged from the sociobiological pressures of the evolutionary process, or else they're expressions of personal preference and taste. In neither case, then, are they normative. So
there's a couple things here. First of all, so Craig, I think here is to use the technical philosophical term, he's pulling the old switcheroo.
Okay.
So he says, oh, no, my claim is not against your moral intuitions at all. I'm not disputing it's wrong to kill children. It's just that just so long as there's a divine command, but I'm not disputing the intuition. No, he is disputing the intuition because our moral intuition is not it's wrong to kill children unless God has commanded me to kill a child. Our intuition is it's wrong to kill children.
Period.
And it's precisely because we have that unqualified intuition that if you suddenly get this deep sense that you're supposed to kill your child as a devotional offering to God, like Dina Schlosser did in 2000, what you're going to do is talk to people and get help because you recognize, no, God couldn't be commanding that. So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing is Craig does an apologist's trick here where he's trying to turn it back on the atheist and say, your only explanation for morality is it's pure subjectivity or it's simply a product of evolution. And that's flatly false. And Craig knows better. He's constantly been challenged by atheists who are moral realists, who believe in the existence of objective morality. He's debated them before on this. And the fact that he won't concede that they have a perfectly legitimate account, for example, atheists who are moral Platonists like Eric Weilenberg, he's an atheist. He believes there's such a thing as an absolute good, and there can also be a naturalistic, non-theistic account of the existence of moral obligation that's objective. Now, you may question various aspects of his philosophical system, sure, but you can do that with any philosophical system. The fact right. that Craig nonetheless tries to say, look, essentially your only options are to accept my divine command theory where you can kill children, or you're left with the moral nihilism of an atheist, I think is just disingenuous.
I mean, I guess sarcastically, if the atheist option prevents you from killing children, I'll take that one then. I'm just saying, you know, sure. Like yeah. if those are my two options, is like God decrees that we can kill children whenever he says it's okay, or no, that's not okay, I'm taking that option. All right, we'll keep it going.
In the absence of a moral authority to issue these imperatives, there wouldn't be any objective right or wrong. But given such a divine moral lawgiver, there is objective right and wrong, but that moral lawgiver himself doesn't have the same moral obligations that we do.
I suppose if I'm being asked to accept wholesale a biblical morality, I suppose... I would look at something like this and as Lincoln said of slavery, think, if this is not wrong, then nothing is wrong. I mean, maybe I can't make a moral claim. Mm. Maybe I can't say that there is such thing as morality and immorality in the universe, but something inside of me tells me that if there is such thing as ethics, it can't look like this. In other words, you're asking me, in order to accept the justification for the actions in this story, to deny one of the most forceful moral intuitions, the exact kind of moral intuition which you might ask me to rely upon in other contexts to yes. establish God's existence at all.
Yes, and as I say, I affirm that moral intuition. If these actions had been undertaken in the absence of a divine command, it would be objectively wrong. But the point would be is that on a divine command theory of ethics, God is free to issue a command that goes against that so long as it is consistent with his just and loving nature.
Right, but that's also interesting, isn't it? So even those words just and loving, I don't know how smashing an infant's skull is just or loving in any capacity, right? Like That seems to be a contradiction between God being the perfect example of or the essence of love and of justice, and also that same entity or being or however we think about God demanding to other people to kill infants because that land now belongs to them, even though the families of that infant have been there for, you know, generational, you know, lines, et cetera. You know, it doesn't add up to me at all.
Yeah, essentially, Craig here is doubling down on the point that Alex rightly found completely unpersuasive, which is his claim that he's not disputing our moral intuitions. He's just saying they always include a divine command, which, again, they don't. So, again, I don't think it's morally wrong to kill children in the absence of a divine command. The moral intuition, it's wrong to kill children. And I love that quote that Alex gave from Lincoln. If this is not wrong, then nothing is wrong.
Right.
So Craig is trying to say God can command the most heinous things imaginable, which genocide certainly is, and yet we can know that somehow he's a good God. So to your point, if that's what goodness is, then again, the moral skepticism arises. We don't really have any sense of what goodness is, because that looks fundamentally contrary to anything I would plausibly recognize as goodness.
That's exactly right. Yes. If that is an example of goodness, then my intuition is way broken then, because, or something's really wrong, right? Because that just, again, it's guttural, the thought of that. I mean, I have children, you know, I have a 2 and a 4-year-old. The thought of them, of that happening to them, is absolutely abhorrent. I don't care who says God gave me the you know, divine command to do it. I'm going to fight them tooth and nail and say absolutely not.
You know, William Webb, a biblical scholar, he wrote a book which I've often engaged with in these conversations, called Corporal Punishment in the Bible. And he looks at the fact that evangelicals talk about spanking their children and as the biblical way of raising them in the fear of the Lord. And what he does is a close reading of the biblical texts, and he shows that what the biblical authors actually endorse is clearly physically abusive. They will endorse hitting children and slaves up to 39 lashes on the back using a hickory switch, or what in Hebrew is called the sebet, leaving scars and doing so in anger, and that is how you raise a child in the fear of the Lord. But, of course, we recognize, thankfully, today that that is abusive, although for centuries, Christians were hitting their kids in that abusive manner because they believed that they had a biblical warrant to do so. Mm. And I'm so thankful now that I don't see when our daughter, she's 22 now, when she was young, we weren't going to obviously hit her like that. But we tried, you know, swatting her on the bum once lightly, because that was the biblical way to raise children. And that first time I was like, this is wrong. I'm not doing this. I don't give a damn what else you say. I'm not raising my child like this. We never physically, corporally punished her again. And she's a wonderfully well-adjusted 22-year-old. Not only do you not have to hit kids in order to raise them well, you shouldn't hit your kids. And if biblical authors could be mistaken about that, they could be mistaken about other things. It doesn't mean, and this is something just in terms of a bigger picture of divine or biblical authority.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you're questioning the Bible. It means you're questioning the point of the Bible. Maybe the point of the Bible isn't how we discipline our kids or to give us a perfectly accurate and inerrant account of ancient or recent history. Maybe there's more going on.
Yeah. No, great, great stuff. I'm on the same page.
Would be to show that in issuing this command, God does something that contradicts his perfectly just and loving nature. And my argument is that that's very difficult to show, because he doesn't wrong anyone, I think, in this. In particular, the difficult case here is the children.
Yes, the children.
What I would say is, first, that God has the right to take anyone's life whenever he wants to. Unfortunately, children die all the time in infancy. And so if God wants to end the life of these Canaanite children early, prematurely, that's his prerogative. But then secondly, on my theology, these children go immediately to heaven. They go to be with God, and therefore come to know a life that is more glorious and more happy than anything conceivable, and certainly far better than if they had been allowed to live and be raised in such a corrupt and evil environment as they were in.
I gotta pause there. I mean, when I first heard that, I really went, wow. I mean, he said the quiet part out loud. I mean, literally a couple of years ago, I tweeted something out, and I said that, you know, if kids just go right to heaven when they die, Why aren't evangelicals in favor of abortion? I mean, isn't that the most merciful thing that we can do, is just send them right up to heaven? And people, oh, this is ridiculous. How dare you say that? And here's William Lane Craig essentially advocating for that position of like, hey, whenever children die, they go to heaven. So why would we? I mean, I think that through all the way, William, like, I think through what you're actually advocating for. Why would we risk children suffering on this earth and living in poverty, not having access to healthcare, when they can just go up to heaven and live forever? That's a ridiculous thing to say.
Yeah, it's on the one hand, it's like narrowly true in the sense that if you believe God is a perfectly loving, merciful God, then when people kill infants and children, then those infants and children will experience blessedness in virtue of God being loving and merciful. But to use that as a rationalization for having killed those children, that's where we're at. We have a problem. Again, Craig uses this language. He says God ends their life prematurely. And time and again, I want to come back to, we're not just talking about ending the life prematurely.
Right.
We're talking about God commanding these various horrific ways of having those children be killed. Now, a couple other things in the background here is Craig assumes some doctrine of an age of accountability, such that before this age, children that are killed by the Israelite soldiers go to heaven, but after that age of accountability, I guess they go to hell. So what is this age of accountability at which children that are killed, it's no longer this blessing for them, but rather they go to a place of torment rather than to a place of blessedness? I'd like to hear more details from Craig on that. I think that's definitely relevant to know if you're going to go around killing children, which ones actually do go to heaven and which do not.
Can I just interrupt you really quick on one point on this? And this also, again, your theology determines how you believe what you think happens to people when they die. James White, most recently, I saw him talking about how he believes that hey, there are some unelect infants. There are some infants who were just never elect to be saved to begin with. So when they die, they go to hell anyway. But because that's not William Lane Craig's position, he can say what he thinks happens to kids when they die, but he doesn't actually know that they actually that's how it works. Because you have all these different people hypothesizing about, you know, age of accountability or election or, you know, God's sovereignty or predestination. So like you're really in the world of metaphysics and theory. But with you're talking about very real world consequences and very real world implications of actual human beings, it just seems to me to be ridiculous to really hold this kind of position and say confidently, well, hey, it's okay that God ordained them to be killed because they're probably in heaven. You don't actually know that, though. You don't know what actually happens when we die. And that to me is just a massive claim to make that you just can't prove. You just can't do it. I'm sorry.
So let's drill down on that, because I think that's a really important point. Yes, there are Christians, particularly of a Calvinist bent, like James White, who would say, well, there are even some infants that die in infancy. They may not have been elect from eternity. They were reprobated. They were elect to reprobation for God's greater glory. Now, Craig, I think you can have a couple grounds under which he wants to argue for amnesty for the least of these. So the first grounds, I think, for arguing for amnesty would be, I think it really is a terrible proof text, but Christians often appeal to it. It's when David lost his child with Bathsheba, and then he laments and says, we will be together again. And people somehow use that to infer that this warrants some general doctrine of an age of accountability, so that the child died before that age and thus is guaranteed heaven. That's not what's going on in that passage at all. He's just engaged in a lament and in a belief in Sheol, that everybody goes to Sheol when they die. Yeah. So to extrapolate some general doctrine of accountability is not warranted by that passage, which means the only grounds I think Craig really has for his confidence that God will save the infants is this general belief about the moral nature of God, which I think is rooted in his moral intuitions. And yet it's those very same intuitions that he's undermined. So it's this fundamentally inconsistent position here. He undercuts the very intuitions that he uses to ground his confidence that infants will in fact be saved. Now, the one other thing I just want to add here, one other quick thing is, yeah, there's infants and small children are killed and maybe go to heaven, but not all of them. I mean, people do survive things like genocide and mass killing. So maybe some of them, they lost an eye, their skull was caved in, and they lost a leg, but they managed to survive. And they lived on the fringes of Canaanite society as this mutilated person for another 40 years. So not all kids who are suffer from the genocide get the blessings of heaven. Some go on to live a life of marginalized agony.
Yeah, and you're right. If God was so angry at the Canaanites where he would demand that the children are killed, why would that be a guarantee that they would end up in heaven? Right? Like, he's already pretty much done with them, it seems like. So there's a 50-50 shot he could have threw them in hell because they're just so wicked. They have to pay for whatever sin that, you know, they've been hanging on to. So again, it's just, to me, it's too much hypothesizing, but unfortunately real lives are at stake in this story, at least, you know, according to how William interprets it. And to me, the math is not math. The math isn't mathing in this circumstance for me. Friends, Holy Week is back. Last week, Christians around the world celebrated Holy Week. Today, TNE invites you to join us for Holy Week, a reflection of the uncomfortable holy moments that brought this community together. Like, holy Trump really endorsed his own Bible and is trying to sell it during Holy Week to pay for his legal bills. Our goal is to hit the $15,000 mark in monthly funding for Project Amplify as we create a better way forward in our faith with less holy moments in the process. As you know, 2024 is a big year with a lot at stake, but you can make a difference. If this work has been meaningful to you, will you help us keep it accessible to others like you? You'll be helping to spread a more loving, just, and inclusive narrative that truly loves our neighbor. Set up a monthly gift of $20 or more, or a one-time gift of $40 or more, and share your own holy moment on our donor wall. You'll be entered to win some Holy Week prizes like free TNE merch, a pineapple pizza, plus 7-Eleven blueberry coffee that I will personally order for you myself, and one predestined winner will get to co-host an episode of the TNE Recap podcast with me and April LaJoy. Already a monthly donor and want to enter the Holy giveaways? Increase your current monthly gift by $5 or more and email us your receipt to enter. Donate now at the link in our show notes. God doesn't choose favorites, and neither does TNE. Winners are not divinely inspired and will be drawn at random from all eligible entries after the campaign ends on Saturday, April 6th.
Hi, my name is Carrie, and I live in Kansas, and I'm a monthly supporter of the New Evangelicals. I started supporting the New Evangelicals in 2020 when it became clear that the evangelical world that I had been raised in and was a part of was doing more harm than good. Since that time and since following the New Evangelicals, I've appreciated the variety of experiences and opinions that are shared on the platform. And I share the concern over the future and the trajectory of the evangelical church. I'm glad I'm able to support this platform and the content as we continue to offer a different voice in contrast to what's being told to us by the evangelical church. Thank you.
All right, let's keep it going.
It's actually a tremendous blessing to these children for them to be killed and go to heaven and be with God.
You must understand how that sounds, saying it was a blessing for these children to be killed and go to God.
Thank you,
this
Alex.
Is something
Thank
that
you.
Dawkins quotes you on directly. And I'm interested in you share my assessment here that even if he's not correct, I can understand why he would hear you say something like that and think that it's morally repugnant, that it's revolting. In any other context, if somebody says something like, well, maybe the murder of these children, I suppose you wouldn't see it as murder, but the killing of these innocent children is a blessing to them, it just seems, again, to run against our intuitions. I mean, you mentioned
does it, Alex? I mean, I think it runs against our naturalistic worldview, where one doesn't believe in an afterlife. But on a theistic worldview, if these children go to a life more glorious and happy than they can imagine, then it is a great blessing. It's just that modern man doesn't believe that.
There are a few ways that I would maybe respond to that. The first is to say that there are areas like take the issue of abortion, for example. Now, you might think that it's immoral to have an abortion because God has commanded that you shouldn't take innocent life, you know, in the absence of some specific divine command, sure. But a lot of the time in this discussion, people do talk in language which points to how this is bad for the child. You know, you're taking away the life of a child. You're committing some wrong towards the child. This position that you're advocating here would seem to remove the ability to do that. You can still say that abortion is wrong if you like, but you can't say that it in any way harms the child. In fact, it seems like you're committed totally right to the here. View that it confers a great good upon the child when, yes, when a parent has
absolutely.
An abortion.
Absolutely. I mean, what it would do, would it would rob the child of the goods of this finite life that he would have enjoyed had he lived 50, 60 years or so. But in place of that, it gives him an eternal life of incomprehensible joy and happiness, which far outbalances the loss of those finite goods. So the reason that abortion is wrong is not because it's bad for the victims. The reason it's wrong is because it transgresses a divine command. It's homicide, and God has commanded us not to commit homicide in the absence of some overriding moral justification, like a policeman or a soldier who needs to take life in order to save life.
That, I mean, this to me just seems like a spaghetti bowl of what? I'm trying to track with all of this, but you know, I mean, there's just so much here. Do you have any thoughts initially while I get my head wrapped around this, because my head's just spinning?
Well, maybe I'll just tie it back for a moment to, so Clay Jones, again, he's this scholar this apologist that Craig quotes to show how evil Canaanite society was. And note that on Craig's reasoning, you've spared the Canaanite child by killing them. You spared them from having to grow up in this morally debauched society. But Clay Jones, of course, makes a comparison between ancient Canaan and contemporary America about how egregiously evil contemporary America is. So what that would provide then is, then we would have a rationale or justification for the mass killing of children in America today to spare them from the egregious evil of America, which is comparable to that of ancient Canaan.
Right.
Like you said, this is just a spaghetti ball of, I don't want to say insanity. I mean, I'll say this, that sometimes philosophers, this is one of the hazards of philosophy, that you end up taking a position that has some really bad implications. And sometimes you end up biting the bullet on those implications because you want to be a consistent philosopher. And I wish Craig was more inconsistent here and said, nope, I don't know how to maybe make sense of these passages, but this is wrong. I wish he would take that inconsistency instead of having the consistency that leads him to absurd and immoral positions.
I think Gatke here said it really well. If child sacrifice and rampant sexual immorality justifies the genocide of Canaan, and conservative Christians think child sacrifice, abortion, and sexual immorality is rampant in America, .. Yikes. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly right, right? I mean, you kind of hinted at this, Randall, where it's like, you can see how people could take what they're reading in this story and go, hey, this is happening in America, whether they're right or wrong is a different discussion. And hey, this is all just God's judgment then. You know, God is just judging us, and this is why it's okay to, as a people group, to commit these kinds of crimes against other people. We could easily get here, and what would be stopping us? Because it's a divine decree. There are many Christians who believe that they hear directly from God. There are people who claim to prophesy on behalf of God, who claim to know the next election cycle, who claim to insist, you know, who's the current president, even though he's not. Those people really believe that God tells them what to do. What is stopping them from getting a word from God that it's okay to kill children because they're, you know, because the nation's under judgment? This is part of God's decree. It's happened before in the Bible. So what's stopping it from happening now? That's why this stuff is so dangerous in my mind, and why we had to respond to it.
Yes. I mean, when I've spoken on this, I always or usually say that in the mid-19th century, there were many Christian apologists who argued for pro-slavery readings of the Bible.
Yeah.
And that was not just some ivory tower discussion. That actually led to people inflicting moral horrors on other people.
Yeah.
And we now would not even consider that part of the possible range of discussion. We would consider out of court any pro-slavery reading of the Bible. Mainstream Christianity would, at least, thankfully.
Yeah, right.
And I think we need, as a church, as the global church, to get to the position where views like Craig's are viewed with the kind of disdain that pro-slavery readings of the Bible in the mid-19th century were viewed, because they do create a background plausibility framework to rationalize moral atrocities in our own day and going forward into the future. And I think that is just something, it's not just an ivory tower discussion.
I completely agree. This has real world consequences, 100%. All right, let's keep it going here. We're getting through this piece by piece.
So it gets back again, Alex, to your ethical theory. Whence do moral obligations arise? And I cannot think of any source for moral obligations more plausible than that these arise as a result of imperatives issued by a qualified authority, in this case, the good himself.
I suppose I have a few things to say. One is that this seems to, you've talked about this in relation to children, the children who get killed, you're conferring a good upon them because they get to go to heaven. But this would surely apply just as much to the adult Canaanites as to the children. I mean, maybe all of the adult Canaanites were corrupt and evil, but if there were any good people among them, it seems like there would be no need to say, no, look how corrupt the society was, because, you know, anybody who is innocent and good, if they get killed, well, they get to go to heaven too. So it seems like a bit of a disposal problem. Any time that there's any kind of slaughter which involves this serious challenge of innocent people being put to the sword on the command of a god, you can always just say, well, you know, they go to heaven, so if anything, you've actually done them a favor. It seems like a bit of a disposal problem. A solution to a disposal problem. It seems like
disposal problem. What do you mean by that?
Like there's sort of this problem of where do these people go? You know, what do we do with these good souls?
And we just say
they just go to heaven. I mean, it seems like a difficult pill to swallow. And what I was wondering is if, despite what your philosophy is, do you understand that intuition? Do you understand why when Richard Dawkins looks at this and thinks it's...
myself. It's so powerful. But, boy, just to reiterate again, what is the problem here? The problem is whether or not there is an internal inconsistency in the Judeo-Christian worldview between affirming that God is all good and all just and affirming that God commanded Israel to drive the Canaanites on pain of death out of the land. And so the question is not, are these things true or did this really happen? It's only a question about, is there an inconsistency between those two propositions? And I think that given a divine command theory of morality, we can see that those propositions are quite consistent with each other. Now, that says nothing.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's pause there, because to me, they don't seem consistent at all, but maybe I'm missing something.
Well, so again, he's technically correct that he's offered a consistent account because all obligation comes from God. Right. And so if God gives these moral obligations, then they constitute, or this moral commands, they constitute our obligations. And so there's no inconsistency with killing children if we've received commands to do so. Narrowly, it's consistent. The question is not, however, as Craig suggests, whether that can be consistent or not. Because again, Descartes can say that animals aren't conscious and give a consistent explanation of animal suffering, consistent with God's nature. The issue is whether we really think that's at all plausible. And I think animals are conscious. And my most basic moral sense and sense perceptual experience is overwhelmingly that animals are conscious. Mm. Likewise, my overwhelming sense is that this is morally wrong. And that's the problem that Craig has to address. Now, when you look at the history of genocide as I did, like David Livingston Smith wrote a book called Less Than Human, and he captures this idea that central to genocides throughout history is always to treat the object of genocide as in some way less than fully human. And this is what people like Jones are doing when they say, well, they were just so horrendously evil and wicked that we had to kill them. Now, interestingly, some other Christians will appeal to a fellow named Michael Heiser.
Oh, I love Michael Heiser.
Michael Heiser's great, but he wasn't a systematician.
Well, that's
or an
true.
Ethicist. He was
the unseen realm. That's his work, you know?
Yes. And, And within that realm, he's great. But
yeah.
he points out a reading of the origin of the problem of the Canaanites is to understand them as descendants of the Nephilim. And yes. So you had to then eradicate them because they pose a threat as the descendants of these hybrid creatures that were, yeah. we originated in Genesis 6. Now, what that actually is, from the perspective of the history of genocide, is one more rationalization. They're not fully human, so we can eradicate them. Now, in fact, we know the descendants of the Canaanites live today in Lebanon, and we can look at their DNA, and they're fully human. So not only is this, I think, demonstrably empirically false,
yeah.
but also it just conforms to this classic approach of dehumanizing an objective particular groups of people in order to rationalize killing them and thereby reconcile your actions with your moral intuitions.
And this is the exact reason why we are so staunchly against dehumanization of anyone, even our strongest detractors or people that we just can't stand, because you're right. Once we start doing that, it puts us, even if it's early on, we're still on that path towards violence because we're making someone less than equal to us. We're trying to create this different hierarchy of, well, you're less human, I'm more human. And it's so important that we really avoid that because it can lead to really unhealthy and really detrimental outcomes for sure. So great point.
About whether or not it's true that when you die, you go to heaven, or that there is immortality beyond the grave. But those beliefs are part and parcel of the Christian, Judeo-Christian worldview. And so the question is, does the Judeo-Christian worldview have an inner inconsistency here? And although Dawkins himself has never interacted with my theory here, in my debate tour with his comrade, Lawrence Krauss in Australia, we talked about this, and Krauss finally admitted that, yes, I had succeeded in showing that there is no inconsistency between these two propositions.
Mm. Dawkins quotes an article that you wrote in response to this issue, and I suppose I should read what the point that he pulled out, which summarizes this position here. You said, "So whom does God wrong in commanding the destruction of the Canaanites? Right. Not the Canaanite adults, for they were corrupt and deserving of judgment. Not the children, for they inherit eternal life. So who is wronged? Ironically, I think the most difficult part of this whole debate is the apparent wrong done to the Israeli soldiers themselves. Yeah. Can you imagine what it would be like to have to break into some house and kill a terrified woman and her children? The brutalizing effect on these Israeli soldiers is disturbing." I must say that the disturbing thing to me there is, I can't shake this feeling. And like I say, you know, I have respect for you as a thinker and a philosopher, and I always enjoy our conversations. But hearing somebody talking about the slaughter of admittedly and explicitly innocent children, not to mention animals, as well as the eradication, driving out of an entire society, and to say that, well, the people who really suffered here were the soldiers who had to kill the innocent woman. It just, in a way that I, like I said at the very beginning of this segment, there's nothing I can do, strictly speaking, to prove that this is that there's no justification for this. But if there is anything that I've ever heard in my life that jumps out of a page with pure moral repugnance in the way that it meets my ears, it has to be something like that.
I completely agree. It's shocking.
I've really thought hard and dispassionately about.
So if you just look, I'm I don't mean this as a cheap shot, but the way that Craig is smiling broadly while Alex is saying, you know, your views, and Alex here as he is polite to a fault.
So charitable. Right? I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And I give him credit for that.
Yeah.
The only concern I might have, I think it could have gone a little harder to emphasize, not getting rhetorically, taking sheep shots or anything, but saying what he gets at here, which is that your views are morally repugnant. You're a nice guy. And Craig is a nice guy. I've first met him in 1993, and I've had several interactions with him over the years. He's a very intelligent, nice person, very amiable. But his views are morally repugnant here. And we don't do ourselves any service by downplaying that. Now, this is a really important point, which one I've emphasized in my work as well, that the impact that this would have had on the people who do the killing.
Yep.
It would have been absolutely devastating Dave Grossman wrote a book in the late 1990s called On Killing, and he looks at the psychology of killing and how properly functioning human beings have an overwhelming aversion to killing other human beings. And it was really in Vietnam that the U.S. military began to overcome that aversion to killing, but it had massive negative sequelae, negative psychological impacts on the soldiers who were dehumanized into killing others. And it expressed itself in things like the My Lai massacre, where you had massacres of dozens and I think a couple hundred civilians. And that is the impact of killing just soldiers, let alone to go in there and have a command to hunt down and attack women, children, infants, the elderly, the mentally and physically handicapped, and so on.
Yeah.
Now, brief principle here. St. Augustine, and this is my paraphrase, which I got some years ago from Eric Siebert, Old Testament scholar. He says, Augustine said, always read the Bible so that you increase your love of God and your love of neighbor. So if you're reading the Bible in a way that diminishes your love of either God or neighbor, you're not reading it right. And when you have a reading that requires you to dehumanize and objectify whole groups of people to try to rationalize morally heinous actions and make them consistent with discipleship of Jesus, you're not reading it right.
You got about 15 minutes left?
We can do it.
All right, we're almost there. I mean, this video is longer than that, but I think that we've really gotten through some of the main meat I wanted to get through, and there's a couple other points I wanted to hit, and then we'll wrap this up. But yeah, I think that Perfect. What you just said is really on the money. So, and again, Randall, thanks for spending your afternoon with me and everyone online on YouTube, and it means a lot. So thank you for your expertise here. It's really great.
This, Alex, and I tried to think as hard as I could, who has been wronged in this action? And it's very difficult to think of anyone who has been wronged by God in commanding this. And then it hit me, well, what about the Israeli soldiers themselves? Because we do know from soldiers who suffer from PTSD that the brutalizing effects of war upon soldiers is terrible and can be destructive. And so I explore at some length, what about the wrong done to these soldiers who had to carry out this command? Is there any motivation that might justify giving such a command to them? In the original article, I suggest that, yes, indeed, there are goods that would be achieved by having them carry out this command, and that God would have morally sufficient reasons for doing that. That's in my original question of the week, number 16, if people are interested in following it up, where I argue that, in fact, even the soldiers themselves would not be wronged by God issuing such a command. But I was looking for anybody that God had wronged. And, you know, the atheist British philosopher Daniel Kame, responding to this sort of tiff between Dawkins and me, he said, I think that even though I'm not a Christian, he said, Craig's position is entirely reasonable, that the children are not wronged in inheriting eternal life. We're all going to die someday. Many children do die, and God's taking the life of these children prematurely doesn't commit a wrong against them. It's actually, they're good. Now, don't let anybody say, oh, well, then we ought to go kill children. No, that would transgress a divine command against homicide. And therefore, in the absence of a divine command, that would be morally wrong. It is only given this divine command from the paradigm of goodness itself that one would be morally obligated to carry out such a horrific action.
But look, you know, one of the things that Randall Ralston talks about as well is
Alex this, likes you.
Example of someone who in 2004 committed infanticide, killed her own child.
Yes.
And says that she did so because she believed God was commanding her to. Now, it will be easy enough to just say, I just don't think God was commanding her to. But the question I want to ask is, given everything you've just said, how can we know this? Because generally, if I ask somebody, look, if God told you to shoot up a primary school, would you do it? And what they tend to say is something like, well, I wouldn't believe that was God because that runs against his nature. The problem is that, sure, you might want to say that, you know, just asking a mother to kill her child for no apparent reason might run against God's nature. It just seems to me that intuitively, if we didn't have this story in the Hebrew Bible, if the story of the Canaanites didn't exist, and we were speaking in the hypothetical, and I said, well, you know, what if God told you to, I don't know, walk into somebody's land and not just drive them out, but if they refuse to go, to kill them and then come back and kill the women and kill the children and in fact kill the animals too. And if they leave the animals, they get punished for not killing the animals as well. What if he told you to do something like that? And I imagine the only thing somebody would be able to say is that, well, of course God wouldn't tell me to do that. And that's how I know that I wouldn't want to follow that command. But that's exactly what's happening here. So it leads us to a radical moral skepticism, in other words, is Rouse's
critique. Yeah, go ahead.
So a few things. First of all, quickly, he referred to that this philosopher Daniel came saying that Craig's position is entirely reasonable. If all he means by that is it's internally consistent, then it's internally consistent, but that's a pretty low bar, as I've said.
Right, right.
Now, okay, so Alex asked about this case of this woman who killed her child, and she believed it was from a divine command. Craig is actually going to respond now. Maybe, actually, I want to hear his response, and then I'll come in afterwards, because there's something I want to say about that.
Here we go.
Oh, I don't think it does that, but notice what you're raising here now is an epistemological question, not a meta-ethical question. This is now no longer a question about whether or not it would be right or even obligatory to carry out such a command. The question now you're raising is an epistemic question about how could I be sure that God has in fact issued such a command. And in the case that you mentioned of Andrea Yates, this was a severely mentally disturbed woman who was hearing voices and was schizophrenic. And it might well be the case that epistemically, Alex, that no one would be justified today in thinking that God had issued such a command. It would be plausible to think that they ought to conclude that, in fact, they're hallucinatory or schizophrenic or mentally ill and go see a counselor. But that's an epistemic question.
Yeah.
Okay, so interestingly, Craig here, he assumes that the case that Alex is referring to is Andrea Yates. And again, we probably should have said at the outset of this whole conversation, but I assume it was implied that there could be triggering discussions, right? Examples and stuff.
Yes.
And so this, again, may be one of those moments. But Andrea Yates drowned several of her children in a bathtub, I believe in 2001. And he assumes that that's what Alex is referring to. But actually what Alex is referring to, I assume, is a case that I've talked about in a few different places, in which I referred to earlier. In November 2004, a mother named Dina Schlosser amputated the arms of her infant, and she believed that God had directed her to do that, that she wanted to give the baby as an offering to God. When the police arrived, because she called the police, she was actually singing "He Touched Me" while the child was dying in the crib. Now, Craig's response, first of all, then, is to assume wrongly that I'm referring to Andrea Yates, and then to already know what the diagnosis is. Well, it's schizophrenia. And the first point I would want to submit here is that Craig's assumption that there must be a mental illness at play, that it must be something like schizophrenia or some kind of psychosis, is based upon his assumption implicitly that God would not command such a thing.
Right.
And further, that the doctors who diagnosed either Yates or Schlosser with this kind of medical diagnosis is likewise based upon an implicit assumption that their beliefs were delusional in nature and that there was no God who commanded such a thing. In other words, the confidence that Craig has here that any contemporary belief that God had commanded a killing is implicitly depends upon the assumption that it is delusional in nature and thus must be psychotic because God would not command such a thing. But if you actually seriously considered that God commanded in the past, he could command it in the future, then you really undercut his assumption that we can just dismiss any case of contemporary devotional child killing as being motivated by delusion or psychosis. I would just add one other thing here. Teresa of Avila in the 16th century had visions of Jesus, which the one common biological explanation today is that they were epileptic seizures, ecstatic epileptic seizures. Now, you could argue that they were ecstatic epileptic seizures, but they were nonetheless divine visions. Mm. And even if you believe that there was some underlying neurological or other explanation for Schlosser or Andrea Yeats having this belief that God had commanded the killing of their children, it's also still possible that God, in fact, did command them, even though they had this underlying psychotic episode.
Right.
So again, Craig really, I don't think, has any basis to have the degree of confidence he does that God would not command such moral atrocities.
No, I really agree. I think that's a really solid place to kind of start wrapping up, because, I mean, where else is there to go? I think that what you said is such a great example of that. And also, I mean, I was debating, I thought about this, and I wanted to give it more time before I said it, but if you wanted an example of what happens when people think that maybe there's something, maybe there's some kind of biblical precedent to what they're doing, look at currently what Netanyahu said, you know, the prime minister of Israel, you know, with Gaza. He said that this, you know, he made a comment about it being related to Amalek. And it's like, and here we have like 30,000 Palestinians dead and 15, 20,000 children dead. No one hopefully would say, no, this is just God's judgment on the Palestinian people for some unspoken sin, because they're just such horrible people. It would never add up today. And we have a prime example of what that could look like, you know? And so I just think it's really important that we recognize when we're talking about the Bible and religion and God, these are very powerful beliefs and ways of thinking that can influence people on one hand to do immense good, right? We know a lot of people of all religious traditions have done a lot of good in the world, including Christians, but there's a shadow side to that, and it can get real ugly real quick when we start trying to find justification off of hyper-literalistic readings of ancient texts that seem to command genocide on the surface, and we apply that to 2024, and we have some detrimental results today. And that's just really important for us to mention, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because Craig himself, I don't know if people caught this, but earlier in the interview, he referred to the ancient peoples not as Israelites, but as Israelis. And so he uses this contemporary nomenclature. And you have to wonder, I mean, it's pretty hard for people not to begin to make connections.
Right.
Well, if God can command things that appear to be beyond the pale morally in the past, maybe he could do so in the future. And maybe you could justify something like an embargo that could lead to the starvation and death of children, because this is not their land to begin with. This is this other group's land. I'm reminded of that quote from Steven Weinberg: "With or without religion, people, good people can behave well, and bad people can do evil. But for good people to do evil takes religion." Mm. Now, honestly, it's not a fair quote, because you can also rationalize evil through, let's say, political frameworks or social economics frameworks. I mean, sports. When I lived in England, you know, the football clubs, they would go at each other physically in brawls in the street. So people can do evil for all sorts of reasons. But you're right. Religion is a uniquely powerful force that can marshal people to do great and noble things or absolutely terrible things. And we have to remove, I think, oppose with every fiber of our beings as Christians, the traditions within Christianity that allow people to have a rationalizing framework to engage in evil.
I couldn't agree with you anymore. Randall, where can folks find you if they want to follow more of your work? Are you online, social media accounts?
Well, you can find me online, Randall Rouser, on Twitter, and I have a website, randallrouser.com. I've been on there for years. Not as active as I used to be, because I'm doing investigations for the most part now, but I do have a book coming out on that topic called Disabuse in the next couple months as well. But if you want to read more on my views, look up my book on this topic, Jesus Loves Canaanites.
Awesome. Randall, I really can't thank you enough for your time and spending an hour and a half, almost 2 hours with me. It means the world. And we'll definitely keep in touch. And if something else comes up, I'll hit you up.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Tim. It's been great.
You got it. Thank you, my friend. All right, everyone. Well, there you go. I mean, I know this was a very, very, very heavy episode. I know this is a heavy topic, but we had to address it. When I watched the whole interview, I said, you know what? We just need to get a response to this and have someone who can really speak to this. I'm so glad that Randall made time. It meant the world. So friends, thanks again so much for being here. If you like this video or podcast, please share it. Subscribe to the channel. That would mean the world. We are a nonprofit organization. We do all this work paywall free because of the generosity of people like yourself. If you want to donate, you can click on the link in our show notes. All donations made in the U.S. are tax deductible and make this work possible. Thanks for being here, friends. I'll talk to you all later on. See ya.